Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Friday, October 30th. We're here with you on another beautiful Friday. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
And we have a very special guest in the studio. We'll get to him in just a few minutes. It's almost the end of the month.
Yeah.
We're going to change our clock, move our clocks back this Sunday, Sunday night. And but today is just, it started as a terrible day, you know, and I hope it gets better because nothing seems to be working. I think somebody would tell you, well, maybe there's like, the retrograde, what is that?
Oh, Mercury.
Mercury retrograde, that's right. And people always say that it affects things that happen and stuff. I don't know if this is happening today, but maybe I'll start believing it.
There is no Mercury in retrograde right now.
No. It's just things are not working.
Right.
Get up in the morning, no hot water. We come here, no elevator. We haven't been able to get our drinking water up here for a few days. So it's just one frustrating thing after another, you know. But I realized getting mad is not going to help me. It's not going to change anything. So I try to stay calm and think about pretty things and nice things.
Good.
Yeah. So how are you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah? You ready for the weekend?
I am.
Yeah?
Yep. Are you?
Yeah.
Great. What are you going to do this
weekend? Looking forward to working. I've got some things to do, like related to work and stuff. So we'll see if they succeed, then Monday I'll be a happy camper.
Great.
Yeah. And if they don't, then I'll be just a little less happy camper.
Okay.
But I'm always trying to be happy. You know, so that's that. They had the debate 2 days ago. We didn't get a chance to talk about it yesterday.
No, I also didn't get to watch it.
I know, and they keep showing the same parts over and over and over on the news, you know. The same, like, 3-4 sound bites or something.
Which sound bites were those?
The one with Rubio and Bush fighting amongst themselves and, Bush telling them, just quit your job in the Senate because you're not there for the voting and all that stuff, and Rubio got back at him, and then they also obviously slammed the NBC staffers, the ones that moderated, because they were asking some really admittedly stupid questions, you know, questions to trick. I'm trying to find in the article here even one question that made him stumble in the beginning, but I can't really find it in this article. I read... but there were a few questions that were like extremely charged, you know, and leading questions, and meant to embarrass or make him not look good or whatever, you know. So that happened with Trump, and so most of the candidates just really got pissed and started saying, you know, let's focus on the issues here. So that was the gist of that debate. I didn't obviously get to watch the whole thing, but I did see parts of it. And
so who do you think won that debate?
It's hard to say because I didn't watch the whole thing. But I think Rubio and Cruz did very, very strongly on that one.
Great.
So, yeah, that's the way it appears to be there. They seem to be the only ones that are in touch with reality there, you know. But Chris Christie mentioned something like, I don't know what context it was in, but he said, I don't understand. You know, we have all these terrible problems with ISIS and the economy and everything, and yet we're talking about fantasy football. So I don't know what that was about, but they must have been talking about it. Mm. So, yeah, some people were pissed off.
Interesting. Well, isn't there another debate coming up, too?
Probably another Democratic debate or
no,
something?
I think another Republican.
Another? Okay, well, there's probably like a million of them, I don't know. And I think I read somewhere there's about 100 days until the primary, so that's about 3 months. So I think, so we'll see when that happens, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe our guest knows. He can help us with that. We're trying to figure out. We know when the general elections are going to be, but we don't know about the primaries. Maybe it's time to look it up.
Yeah.
So how did your show go on Wednesday?
Went well.
It's complicated. Yeah, it went according to plan and everything.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
So what did you guys talk about?
Well, we had Monica Padilla on.
Right, from Survivor.
Right, and we talked about her experience with Survivor Second Chance and how it was different from the first time she went on and what her strategies were. Obviously, she is no longer on the show. She's a castaway. So she told us what happens, you know, like when that is the case. And also, she was like surprised that she even got voted off.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, she thought she was doing well, I guess, right?
I mean, or she didn't think she'd be getting kicked off. Yeah. So, you know, it was an interesting perspective to hear because you just see her on TV and then she told us what was happening behind the scenes. Like, yeah. She had friendships that she thought were real friendships and an alliance, and it turned out that person's the one that sold her out.
Really?
Yeah.
Stabbed her in the back.
Basically. So, wow. You know, we talked about that, what yeah. it was like to do long distance with her boyfriend because she had to leave him for 3 months to go do the show. And they can't obviously talk while she's there. So.
Yeah. So that was interesting. Huh?
Yeah. I mean, they're just a great couple. And one of the things she said was that they just like trust each other blindly. So it's like.
Yeah. You see, that's very important. If you can't like let your partner or your spouse or whatever like be on their own without you worrying about them, then you've got a problem.
Right. And so they were able to do that, you know, for several months. And he supported her going and doing this thing. And she got to focus on it while she was there and not have to worry about him. And
right. And
I think they just have a very good relationship.
Yeah, very cool. Very nice to hear. It's always nice to hear people in good relationships.
Yes.
For crying out loud. But, a lot of people seem to be getting married. I don't know. I mean, it's like people, more Facebook friends, not really people my age, but a lot of people get married, you know. So it's funny because, you know, over the years we've had people on the show and, you know, they didn't have anybody and stuff. And then suddenly they're like getting married and babies and all that stuff, you know. So,
yeah.
So some things are working, you know.
Well, that's nice to see.
I know. one more thing. Okay, so we're moving the daylight saving time, and there's a few like myths about it, but they're saying that it doesn't really save a lot of energy. So it's a bunch of baloney. Do you like daylight saving
time? No.
You don't like it?
No, I like longer days.
Well, it is longer day when it's daylight saving time. Over the summer.
Right, but now we're falling back.
Yeah, now we're falling back to the original time.
I don't like
I know.
Longer nights.
I know.
Makes me lazy, makes me tired, makes me not want to do anything.
I know, right? I mean, it starts like the night starts at 4:30, 4:45 or something.
I don't like it.
In the middle of winter. And you go, what happened to my day? You know, I still should have 3 hours.
Yeah.
So
it doesn't make me want to go to the gym. It, like, I don't want to leave my house.
Right. That's why some people are saying maybe we should just keep this time
year-round,
you know? Yeah. And because who cares that it's dark at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know? That's not that big a deal.
It's not a big deal to me.
Yeah. I know. Okay, so that's that. And, okay, well, let's get to our guest now, who's sitting here patiently. And we're very excited to have him. We have Mr. Mike Garson in the studio. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Nice to be here.
Yes. And you seem to be a happy person.
No complaints.
Right? You don't complain about things, so that's a good thing. And you've made it pretty far in your career and everything, probably by staying positive, right?
That's part of it, and the music itself, you know, sort of brings its own joy. So I don't know how happy I'd be without my music.
Really? Yeah. So you're one of the lucky ones who got to make music their profession and actually succeed in it and go far with it. So, and we'll get to all the things that you've created and everything and the main reason why you're here in a little while.
That's fine.
But we want to find out a little bit about you. So, you're pretty experienced musician. When did you start with music in your life? Was it at an early age, like usually is the case?
I started in Brooklyn when I was 7.
Really? Oh, so you're originally from Brooklyn?
Exactly.
Wow, very cool. So go on.
And I haven't stopped playing since. Yeah. I started working professionally at 14.
Really? And what were you playing?
I started with classical.
Uh-huh.
Then I got into jazz.
But what instrument were you playing?
Piano is my instrument.
A piano is your instrument.
Everyone in a Jewish family in Brooklyn had a piano, so it was peer pressure. I'd rather play baseball outside. Yeah. So my mom played, my dad played by ear, and my sister played, so I had no alternative.
That's true, huh? So you had a musical house,
a musical
family. A
very
family.
Musical house, yes.
Wow, that helps, I guess, huh?
That helps.
Yeah. You see, I had parents that were not very musical. And thus I didn't make a career out of this. I mean, I can't blame them, you know. I mean, parents will always say get a real job. But you had the support from early on.
I had a lot of support. In college, I was a pre-med student.
Really?
Yeah, but the music just pulled me too much. So I, after I dissected my first pig and made spare ribs and chopped liver, I was back to the music.
Hey, at least you tried.
I gave it a go, very nice go at Brooklyn College, but the music was just, it was meant to be.
Wow. So it must have consumed you early on in your life. Did you take lessons and stuff? Or, because you said your parents played or your dad played by ear, right? Did you take lessons?
I took lessons for probably 15, 20 years. I had great Juilliard teacher. I had very famous jazz teachers, Herbie Hancock, Bill Evans. I mean, I was in the New
York. They were your teachers.
They were teachers of mine in the 60s. I was really blessed. So I had all them. And then I did all that hard work, and I get a call one day to go work with David Bowie. And I was hired for 8 weeks, and I've been with him over 40 years.
Wow. Do you still play with him?
Well, I did his last tour. The last tour was 2005.
Right, that's right. Yeah, he hasn't performed for a while. Do you think he's going to
he's like the type of guy I could call tomorrow or I never hear from him. And that's how it's been my whole life because I was only hired for 8 weeks and I'm still there.
Yeah.
So you never know. He's on the East Coast, but I've done about 18 albums with him and about 15 tours. So I've been...
Wow,
you know,
those are staggering numbers. I mean, my God, you know, it's like that's a lot of... I mean, that's many years to work in any one situation. But so how did they find you? I mean, how did they come to you?
This is very crazy. I was giving a piano lesson in Brooklyn. My daughter was 2 years old. Uh-huh. And I get this call from David Bowie's manager. And I was a jazz musician playing in jazz clubs. Uh-huh. And I had just finished playing in a club on 69th Street and Broadway. I made $5. And there was three people in the club. And I was playing with a sax player who worked with Miles Davis, Dave Liebman, and I was playing with all these great musicians. And I'm thinking, something's wrong with this picture. I've just put in practicing 8 hours a day for 10 years, and now $5, and I have a family. I think, maybe I'll go out with a rock band. And I swear to you, the next night, David Bowie's manager called. But I didn't know anything about rock, so I didn't know who Bowie was.
Right.
And they said he's coming to do his first American tour. Would I like to play piano? I had just played the week before on a singer's album called Annette Peacock. She happened to know him. She was like an avant-garde weird singer, and he liked that kind of stuff. And I played on her album. It was called I'm the One. He came to New York, and he said, I don't know any pianist here, and we need a piano player in the band. So she said, this is the guy you should use. And I got the call. I went and I left my student to babysit my daughter. My wife almost killed me. And I went to Manhattan to RCA Records, and I walk in there, and these guys are all in different colors, silver hair and blonde and red, and they're decked out, and I'm in like a T-shirt, and walked in there, and the guitarist, his name is Mick Ronson. He passed on in the 90s, but he was an amazing guitar player. And he gave me this song by Bowie called Changes. I played for 7 seconds. I read the music, and he said, you got the gig. I said, I didn't even start to play. And he says, I can tell. And that was
Whoa.
It.
What a cool story.
Isn't that a great story?
Yeah. It is. So you really integrated the piano into your life. I mean, because by then you had played for a while.
Yes. I was in my 20s, so I had been playing already, you know, 18, 20 years.
Yeah,
And I had studied classical and jazz, and now I was going to bring some of those elements to the rock world. And that's right. how he used me. There was an album called Aladdin Sane that we did in 1973, and all the piano playing is me on that. And it was like putting whipped cream on the cake for his music, because they were just like a great rock band, and I put all this jazz and classical on top. And I still get emails every day from fans all around the world from this one particular
amazing.
Track. It's really amazing.
Amazing, wow. And you see, and this is cool because you were discovered for your talent, you know. It's not like it was sort of like a business thing or like that you knew somebody.
Nothing.
It was you were totally discovered based on your talent by another musician.
That's a good point. I never looked at it that way, but you're right. You're right.
Yeah, you know, I mean, your talent proved itself, and it's not like you had to, I knew somebody who knew Bowie and all that stuff. It was somebody that said, hey, this is the guy you should have, you know.
Yeah, because I had played the piano on this lady's album, and then she liked my playing. So when he asked for a pianist, you know, wow. I was on her mind. So the fact that I was out there doing it helped. That would be the only aspect of public relations that was there, the fact that I was just playing.
Right, exactly. And it transformed your life. I mean, that one event...
One event chance, because I'd still be playing in those jazz club making $5. And I still do those gigs around town here. Now it's up to $50, so I'm fine. But I do it more because I love it. And I do these other things to be able to live with my family. I went out with Smashing Pumpkins. I did their last tour. Played with Nine Inch Nails, Gwen Stefani. And then all sorts of jazz people in the day, like Stan Getz and Freddie Hubbard. They're not
even alive.
Stan Getz
is my favorite.
I played with him in France in 1980.
Wow.
And Freddie Hubbard, who died a few years ago. I played with Mel Torme, Nancy Wilson, Martha Reeves from Martha and the Vandellas. This is before you guys' time.
Yeah, right.
And just very blessed. And the gigs that I turned down were crazy because I was sort of obsessed with jazz. I turned down Sarah Vaughan, Frank Sinatra, and Buddy Rich.
What?
And God knows, you talk about
Frank Sinatra.
You talk about. I felt like playing fusion, and at the same time, I went out with Stanley Clarke, which was a great band. He's a great bassist, but my head was not on straight. But I was following whatever my integrity was at that moment. Now I would have done him looking back.
Right, but you can't regret what you did because I think obviously you've done a lot of great. Great things in music, you know. I mean, you've gotten far. I mean, did that, like, improve your self-confidence when you felt that, hey, they picked me out of all people to play with Bowie?
You know, you like to think that you have your own self-confidence, but you don't until you get approval from your peers.
Right.
And the better they are as artists and musicians, and the better you deliver as an artist, the more you feel better about yourself. I mean, you shouldn't need that approval, but it sure is an acknowledgement of the hard work you've done.
Right. Now, were you living the rock and roll life during those years? I mean, you know, David Bowie is not a jazz singer, obviously, so lavish lifestyles, things like that. Were you involved in all that?
Well, I was touring with them, so...
Yeah, you were surrounded by rockers.
I was surrounded by it. We moved out to the Beverly Hills Hotel when we were playing our first concert at Universal. This is 1972. And... we're in these bungalows at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Right next to me was Elton John, and the door next to us was Perry Como, who's an old singer. And my daughter was with me, and who was two, and my wife is there. And she would sort of miss going into our cottage, and she'd be in all of a sudden Elton's cottage or Perry Como, you know. So I was around all of that. I did not partake in the drug scene because I just saw destruction.
Really?
Because I had lost a lot of friends.
Really?
And from heroin and all sorts of things. So I, thank God, never got involved in any drugs. And I've been married 47 years. So I was with my wife. She toured with us. So I didn't partake in the crazy part of it. But what I loved was the music. And I still do.
Yeah.
But I let them do their thing. It was nice to watch.
Right.
That's great, though, that you could travel with your family.
That was great. I mean, my wife would come out to the important concerts, Carnegie Hall and Universal and things of that nature. And then, of course, she was bringing up my daughters, you know, the rest of the time.
Yeah. Now, I see that you also have a book, right? So do you describe those years in your book? It says Bowie's Piano Man. That's the name of
The biography just came out.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And in the summer, the soft cover is being written, and they're adding another 50 pages because it's still going on. I actually just believe my career hasn't started. This first six decades has been an internship and now my apprentice. And now I'm beginning because I'm doing this healing music, and I've written a symphonic healing suite, and I've been working with a brain surgeon and scientist from Vanderbilt College in Nashville. So my whole life is now doing another thing because I've done everything else. I've played the concerts, I've played Hollywood Bowl, I've played the punk music, the jazz, the fusion, the classical. So now I'm writing what I'm thinking might be healing music, and we tested 30 of my pieces out on 100 patients, and they chose their first they chose their favorite 12, and that became my symphonic healing suite. And we've been performing this all. I played it at Segerstrom Hall in Orange County last year, which is a beautiful hall. And we're going to be doing it in Nashville, April 2016. So that's what I'm working on now. It's just another aspect of the music. And you survey it and you test it out. We're testing out. My grandson has autism, so he lives with us. And now I'm working with these scientists at Vanderbilt, testing out my music on these children to see what it does to their brain and if it helps them and if not and all this kind of stuff.
So, how did you get hooked up with the brain doctor in the first place?
This is really insane. He was a Bowie fan. He played the piano. He wanted to be me, and I was a pre-med student. I wanted to be him. And we met somewhere, and I came to him with this idea, and I said, I want to write the symphonic healing suite, and we need...
How did you know that music would heal something to do with the brain?
I sensed it starting about 20 years ago. And then when my grandson, who has autism, is living with me, I saw how anxious he was, just very nervous and this kind of thing and OCD. And I put him on my lap one day and I started playing some Mozart. And he kind of melted into my lap. And I said, this relaxed him. And then I moved him into playing the piano, and now he's playing 2 years. He's actually written the piece for me for my birthday, and that's going to be in this performance with the symphony orchestra in Nashville with an opera singer and a pop singer and jazz musicians and classical, a children's choir. It's a mammoth work. And so he's going to come up on stage, and my other grandson plays the drums. He's going to play Kunga drums. So It's a whole family thing mixed with you know, beautiful doctors and scientists. And I suspect it'll take 20 years for what I'm doing to go into the culture and the consciousness. But there are people we all know. We all listen to music, you know, and right. It must do something to us. So my idea is it either helps a person mentally, stress-wise, emotionally, maybe physically if they're lucky, spiritually for sure. And I like the idea of the music having a preventive medicine aspect rather than after you're sick, maybe start listening to it before the things you like. So I'm trying to gear the music to have a, you know, meditative, relaxing thing, but we don't know. We're in the testing. All the results so far on a general level are fine, but it takes these scientists years to see what caused this, what caused that. But intuitively, as an artist, I know music has helped me from the very beginning. Mozart, yeah. Beethoven, Keith Jarrett, it didn't matter. You know, Vladimir Horowitz, Chopin. There were things that affected me. Bowie songs, you know, Beatles songs. I grew up with all that. So that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is this project called?
It's called the Music Heals Project. That's the foundation. And the website is music-heals.com. That's where you could see all these pieces I've written, and people can donate and what have you to the foundation so we could keep this work going. But that's what I've been doing the last 4 years. But I still go out and play normal concerts and play on people's records and what have you.
Very interesting. Yeah. So you continue doing this. I mean, yeah, you never get
60-70% is composing this music and performing the symphonic stuff. But the other 30-40%, I still teach and give lectures and I play on records, and I do some touring. I have a jazz trio and this kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah. What's your jazz trio called?
The Mike Garson Trio.
And where do you guys play?
That's, you know, all around the world. You know, I've played a lot in L.A. and over the years, all the jazz clubs. I think I closed down 7 jazz clubs since 1980. Dante's, Carmelo's, Pasquale's, then none of them are there anymore. Jazz Bakery. I mean, it's very hard to survive in a jazz club. So I've played all those clubs. And then, of course, concerts all around the world. Played a lot in Israel, New York at the Blue Notes, and, you know, wherever.
Cool. So you've been around.
Around. I mean, I must have played 5,000 concerts, and I've probably written as a composer over 5,300 pieces of music.
Wow.
From jazz to classical to pop to rock.
How do you not repeat yourself in on any of those songs? I can't even write one song.
Well, you know, a lot of it is from all the years of drilling and repetition and all the practicing. See, I was in the Army band in the 60s because I wasn't to be drafted. Because my marks weren't high enough at college, so they said, if you can't get your marks high, you're going to be drafted. And I couldn't get the marks high enough. The music was A's, but the other classes I wasn't good at. So now I'm faced with going in the Army. It's Vietnam, and this wasn't my cause at all. So I found that if I get in the band, do an extra year, then I don't have to, go shoot people. I'd rather play music notes. Yeah. That heals more than shooting people, I felt, you know. So when you're there, you play in the marching band, and you know, I would play for all the generals and all this kind of stuff, and you get your stripes by how good you are. So I used to practice 8 hours a day. When I was home, it was maybe an hour or two, and I was kind of just kid fooling around. But now it became serious. So I developed that discipline of 8 hours a day, and then after 3 years of that, I went into my career, and I was still kept that practicing going. You see how it works?
Yeah.
Amazing. We're talking to Mike Garson, a musician, a piano man, has played with many great acts. And you started this organization, or did you start it, or did you join it, the Music Heals?
Music Heals had another name, Dr. Doomer, who's the brain surgeon that I work with. He had a foundation for stroke recovery. We got interested when we were talking music. He does operations on Parkinson patients where he puts two pacemakers here and he runs a wire up to the brain and it gives off an impulse and it helps reduce the drugs in half and stops the shaking. He does
really?
Some very advanced surgery and it doesn't cause too many problems from what I understand with the Parkinson's patients. So we got talking about all this and that's how it's and then we changed the name from the Foundation for Recovery of Strokes or something to Music Heals. It's much easier.
Yeah,
Music Heals Project, and so it was his foundation initially, but then I brought the music aspect to it, and he loves music, and so this is what we're doing.
Yeah, so you guys believe that with music you can actually help conditions like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's and stroke. Stroke victims as well, right? I mean, because I see these are all associated with you. So, and you mentioned autism as well. So, I mean, that's really amazing, you know, and that's what really captured my attention when you guys contacted us, is to know that music can actually heal such serious conditions or illnesses.
Well, you know, it would be an over-exaggeration to
not
say.
Maybe not heal.
Let's put it this way. It's going to be different with each person, but I know for sure that it does something, like with Alzheimer's people, for example, they like familiar songs from their youth.
Right.
So in this next concert that we're doing, we're using a lot of famous country singers and people like that, and we're going to do some Beatles songs and Willie Nelson and all this kind of stuff before we do my healing suite, because those people don't know about original music that I write. They know what they heard when they were kids. So
Right. That
aspect helps the Alzheimer's children. I read an article this morning in the news that said that if you get some of the dementia and Alzheimer's patients before it gets too bad and you get them singing show tunes and songs they remember, not just listening, but singing them, they start to come to life.
Yeah.
So we're going to get the audience singing these songs when I do this concert. And so there's that aspect. The Parkinson patient said that when she listens to my music and she dances, her balance is better. So there's a little result there. I never thought in my wildest dreams, and I still don't, that the music would take the place of medicine.
Right.
But it's an additional modality, just like people say, well, it should be meditation a little bit. Here's the music. Certainly the medicines that they use and all the other aspects that help the real healing. But if the music could aid as an adjunct, I'm happy.
Yeah, sounds good. Somebody's trying to call, so let me see who this is just so we can humor them. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Garson. It's an honor to be hearing you and speaking with you. I've been following you for many, many years. I'm fascinated with this Music Heals project and was just wondering where you all are planning on going from here with this. What other aspects of this are you looking to explore?
It's a great question. What's your name?
John.
Hi, John. I plan on putting an app together to have my music in every hospital and nursing home around the world, so it's just not in concerts. So therefore, it makes it available on an app that'll take another year. And then I plan on doing the Symphonic Healing Suite with the major symphonies around the world. So that would be L.A. Philharmonic, Israeli Philharmonic, New York Philharmonic, Chicago. My next one is with the Nashville Symphony in April. And we might do one in Long Beach out here. And there's a symphony orchestra not far from my house in the valley called New West Symphony. They're interested for 2017. So I could see over the next 5 years, 50 of the major orchestras around the world. Plus, obviously, I'd like to have it filmed so it would be an HBO special or a PBS special. So not just a few hundred thousand people that see it in a concert hall, but the rest of the world could see it. At the very least, the music is enjoyable, and that alone makes me happy, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, John, any other questions for Mike?
I'm enjoying this tremendously. I just thank you very much for having him on, and Mike, thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for calling. Yeah, so that's very interesting. So you brought some music, and this is your music?
Yes,
that you brought in. So you composed it. Do you perform it as well?
Yes, or I played the piano on it.
Really? Mm-hmm. Amazing. So, okay, so we're going to play, we're going to start with track 4, which is Lullaby for Our Daughters. Tell us a little bit about that one.
So I wrote this lullaby for my daughters back in the 90s, and it was always very soothing, and people would ask for it. So it became part of the healing suite. So it was an instrumental piece originally, and I met a great jazz singer named Nina Freelon. She's very big in the jazz world. She's like our Sarah Vaughan. And she wrote words to it. And she's singing on this, and it's Here's the Lullaby, and I'm playing the piano and what have you, you know.
Wow, very cool. And when was this song composed?
I composed it at around 96. This arrangement I did about a year or two ago. You're actually hearing a version that's not even released except for people who were been donating to the foundation. So I haven't even finished the final mix of this track, but it's certainly good enough to play.
Sounds good. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear Mike Garson's music right now. Here we go. Thank you. My Garson. You know, this song, it's a lullaby, right? Mm. And, I mean, I was feeling it doing things to my body where, like, I was going to, like, just drift away, you know?
That's,
I mean, it's
part
it's,
of the idea of the healing suite.
Yeah, you know, it makes you feel sort of like you're floating or something, you know?
Thank you.
And I'm sure different people get different effects from it.
Right. And that's my whole intention with my music. It's not to say it's going to cure something. If it brings a little joy and it gets the endorphins going and a person feels something, then that is healing.
Yeah.
You know, we used to talk about it, it's entertaining the music or it gives us a lift or this or that. But I think it goes deeper than that. I've been working with another neurologist named Dr. Barry Bittman in the East Coast. This guy's an interesting character because he's a doctor. He's the chairman, the CEO of the Yamaha Wellness Institute, which is a nonprofit part of Yamaha. He works for a gigantic insurance company, and he's a master of the Kabbalah. I mean, this guy is a genius. And he also worked on some of the genome stuff with the, all the stuff that they found with genes. And he feels that my music, probably other people's also, but he did his research with my stuff. He feels that my music affects the DNA at a very deep level. Again, till we get to prove all this with the scientific methods, it's going to take a while. But intuitively, that's what he feels. We have a little duet. It's called The Physician and the Musician. And we go around and we play for doctors around the world. And everyone's on board with this. More doctors' children play the piano than any other type of person.
That's really?
Listen to that statistic. Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Yeah. So now tell people how can they can become involved, how they can help, because obviously, you know, this affects a lot of people, and you've dedicated a lot of your time and effort to help out people, you know, that are sick and all that. So, you know, so, I mean, your music is like, I'm feeling like I could relax with it, you know. I could meditate to it, you know. I mean, I could even hypnotize somebody with it, you know. It just, it puts you, I think, in a different state.
Well, when I was listening to the music, because I move on and I've written so much music, I haven't heard it for a while, and I was the receipt of my own music, but there's other musicians on there and the singer, and it was spiritually healing me. It gave me a great feeling when I was listening to music. So, you know, that's enough for me.
Yeah. No, it forces you to slow down and really check things out. Now, I'm curious to hear another track so we can sort of like compare the different kinds of music. So so tell us what other track from this album we should play. You mentioned number 7, Respect. You want to play that one? Or
we should do that one and then after that, the tango.
Okay, well, we don't have much time. We only have time for one more. So you want to do the tango then?
Well, the tango has an interesting story, so we should do that. This Parkinson patient actually asked me to write it for her. And when we performed my healing suite, the symphonic suite, we had 100 musicians and singers on the stage. She and her husband came out and danced this tango. And she said that her balance was better than when she walked. So this is the piece I wrote for her.
So this is that story you were telling us. Okay,
yes.
So let's see. El tango de curación?
Yeah, that means tango of healing.
Oh, okay.
Cool. I asked my daughter, she's a Spanish professor, but I don't know one word.
Oh, so who gave you the lyrics? The woman did?
There's no lyrics on it, it's instrumental. I just wanted the title to have cure in it or healing.
Oh, okay. All right, well, let's listen to this one.
Thank you.
Yeah, so so this is interesting. Now, how do you compose something like this? I mean, I can understand writing a song, a pop song and stuff. Do you just sit at the piano and just let your fingers go, or do you get a music in your
head? Well, the inspiration must be there. Otherwise, it's purely mechanical. So you have to feel inspired. So here's a woman in her 70s who has Parkinson's. She says, I was a dancer in my earlier years, and I had a dance studio, and would you write me an Argentine tango? So I looked at her and I thought, okay, maybe I'll even combine the tango with the waltz, because this piece has tango elements and waltz element, as if you were to listen to the full development of it.
Right.
And so because she requested the piece, it inspired me. I went to the piano and listened to a few tangos of some famous Argentine composers, Piazzolla in particular, who's very famous Argentine tango composer, and it inspired me. And in 10 minutes, the piece was finished.
Really?
And then I brought
10 minutes. Wow. 10 minutes.
And then I brought this violinist in, and he's playing. Yeah. In the symphony, we have the full orchestra doing it, but this was a small version with just piano and violin.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was for her. Yeah. It's not my initial musical resonance or instincts. I love the piece, but it's not what I normally write, as you rightfully saw. Right. But boy, when you saw her dancing on the stage, that's why I had asked if we could do videos, because I have the video of it, but I was confusing the shows.
Right. But this is very interesting. So she was dancing to this, and she felt she could do more.
She was with a husband on the stage, and there wasn't a dry eye in the place. It was really pretty emotional. I could barely play on the piano. And you're seeing her. And the biggest thing is she was smiling.
Yeah.
And as soon as the song was over and she was walking over to take a bow, she almost fell. But when she was dancing, she was fine. I mean, so these are good signs, good indications. So this is what helped her.
Right. And this is cool, you know, because you're helping people out, you know. I mean, you're really contributing to people you don't necessarily know, and not just making music for the soul, but for your health, you know. I mean, for your well-being. And I think, you know, and I mean, I highly respect this. I mean, I think you're doing a great thing here. So I did start to ask you, then I cut you off. How can people help? How can they find out more about this? I mean, do you guys look for people to help financially?
Of course. We're a foundation. They would just go to music-heals.com.
Okay.
And they could hear some of the music, and they could give a dollar, $5, $10, $1,000, whatever, or nothing, you know.
Right.
But obviously it's a foundation, and when we put on these concerts with 100 musicians on stage, it's expensive. And just the rental of the hall in Nashville, it was like $36,000 for a Thursday night, because it's a gorgeous hall, and they have a beautiful organ. And so everything, the hiring the conductor and bringing out the harpist from L.A. to there, and I have a 14-year-old saxophone girl that's coming out to play with us, and my two grandsons are going to perform. So it's a whole trip. But so that's where the monies go to, and of course more research. You know,
yeah. Can people buy a CD with your music on it?
I'm going to eventually put out the CD commercially. A lot of it is online now at the music-heals.com thing, so they could listen to it. I mean, ultimately, I'd like the foundation to have enough money that I could give it all the way for free, because I don't have no desire to make money from it. As long as the foundation could keep me going composing the music, I would rather share it.
Right. So you're not doing it for the money, obviously. There's a deeper thing to it.
It's deeper. You know, everyone has to make a living, but that comes way down on the line, you know.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, you feel you've accomplished a lot, and you have accomplished a lot. I mean, 5,000 pieces of music, that's a lot, you know. 40 years of music, you know, professionally and, you know, with the major stars is a big deal.
And yet you feel you're just getting started.
Yeah, I just turned 70, so I've been playing for 57 years professionally.
Wow.
And I've never stopped. But all along the time I've been performing, I've taught over 10,000 piano students, because I love teaching.
Yeah.
So I still teach.
Incredible numbers.
I'm still teaching. Yeah. They're big numbers because when you look through a lifetime of work, but I honestly believe that now I could make a bigger contribution because the other stuff is a little more ego-based and fun and vanity and, you know, power and money, all those kind of things. But I always loved the music, and I knew it was going deeper than just the surface things that we think about with music. And now I'm getting a chance to experience it by getting feedback from others who were reached by the music. So really, it's a chance to pay back after being kind of like wrapped up in yourself, most like most musicians and artists are.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like it's so easy to get into ego. Wayne Dyer said, ego stands for edging God out. I like that.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Cool. Yeah.
So, you know, I know that other game, and now I'm enjoying this one.
Right. Mike Garson, you guys can also go to his website, MikeGarson.com, and get the book here, Bowie's Piano Man, The Life of Mike Garson. You want to check it out. Sounds fascinating to me.
Yeah, you could read that on Kindle, you know, because
really?
The book came out in England, so it's a hardcover. It's hard to get. You could buy it on Amazon, but it's easier to just download it and read it on your iPad, you know.
Yeah.
But some people like a book, you know.
Yeah, very cool. Well, much success to you, Mike.
Thank you
You're
so much,
doing a lot of great things.
Thank you, Jen.
And we really, you know, I respect people that devote their time, even a little bit, although you devote a lot of time. But, I mean, in general, when people go out of themselves and devote a little to other people for their well-being, I salute that.
Thank you. Well, so, that's what you're doing by having the show, aren't you?
Well, we're doing it for ego purpose.
There's nothing wrong with that either.
Hopefully we help people while doing it.
Right, and we're not edging God out. God forbid. Mike Garson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
Everybody, have a great weekend. You too, Jen.
Thanks. Happy Halloween, everyone.
Happy Halloween. That's right. We didn't even mention that. So go out there, be careful, and we'll see you on Monday.
Listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.